40. The Last Chapter. Nevertheless, the condition of comradeship, dangerous as it is, has its weak point, as does every condition that is based on deception, doping, and mumbo-jumbo. The moment, namely, that its external requisites are missing, it disappears into thin air. That has been observed many thousand times, even with genuine, legitimate wartime comradeships, men who in the trenches would have given their lives for one another, and more than once shared their last cigarette, feel the greatest shyness and inhibitions when they meet again as civilians. And it is not the civilian meeting that is deceptive and illusory. Our comradeship at Jüterbog had been an artificial fit of drunkenness fabricated by the Nazis, and it evaporated with eerie rapidity in the space of a single week between two parties. The first was our leaving party at Jüterbog. It was, to put it briefly, an orgy of comradeship. There was an alcoholic, heightened atmosphere of community, and if we had not already used du to greet one another, we would have sworn brotherhood and started doing it that evening. There were speeches, and in his, the camp commandant, an SS-Standartenführer, who had survived the departure of his men and the arrival of the Reichswehr, finally revealed the secret of our ideological training. We did not need great orations, he said, or interminable lectures and explanations. Being young German men, all that we needed to show, quite automatically, that we were at heart National Socialists, was to be removed from our deceitful bourgeois environment and our dry-as-dust legal files and put in the right surroundings. That was the secret of the success of National Socialism, that it appealed to something that was part of every German's make-up. Those of us who were not yet National Socialists knew now that it was in their blood. The rest would look after itself. The appalling thing was that there was some truth in this speech, if you interpreted it correctly. It really was true that you had only to place us in the right circumstances for a kind of chemical process to corrode our individualities and turn us into an unthinking mass, easily arousable for any cause whatever. This process reached its climax that evening. There was universal brotherhood. Everybody praised and proposed toasts to everybody else. The lieutenant praised our military prowess. We praised the lieutenant's strategic genius. A petty officer, replying humorously to a toast, stated in his gruff manner that he had never dreamed that lawyers and academics would make such good soldiers. Sieg Heil. There were humorous poems written for the occasion, and read out by their authors to general acclaim from the undiscerning, tipsy audience. We sang that we were Geyer's Black Band one last time, and at the hey-hos, beer glasses and chairs were smashed. We were like a tribe of self-satisfied cannibals at a victory celebration. Then some dormitory or other was attacked with water bombs, and there was a battle royal. Suddenly some of us had the drunken idea that somebody ought to be dragged under the water pump, not because he had committed an offence, just as a kind of symbolic human sacrifice to the god of comradeship. The chosen victim demurred, and several others immediately offered themselves, but that did not satisfy the sacrificial priests, so they started to persuade him that he should accept it of his own free will for his comrade's sake, and so that the party would not end on a sour note. It was rather spooky, but also transfigured by high spirits, alcohol, and madness. The victim finally agreed. "I'll do it, but only douse my head," he said. "I don't want to sleep in wet pyjamas again." They promised, but of course once he was under the pump, they doused his whole body. "You assholes," he shouted. But the Homeric laughter that greeted this left him no choice but to join in. It was an orgy of barbarity. The next day we left for Berlin, and during the following week we took our oral examinations. Everything was different. We wore civilian clothes again, used flushing toilets and knives and forks at table, and said thank you instead of shit. We bowed to the old gentlemen who were our examiners, and answered their questions in educated literary German, mentioning such things as the law concerning mortgages or joint property. Some failed their examinations, and some passed. A deep gulf opened up between these two groups. We saw our own acquaintances again and greeted them with good day rather than Heil Hitler. We had conversations again, real conversations. We rediscovered our own existences and got to know ourselves again. Asked about our experiences in the camp, we felt embarrassed, mumbled, "It could have been worse," and explained briefly that we had learned to shoot and been taught strange songs. I began to think of Paris as though it actually existed. In the camp it had had no reality. On the other hand, the camp itself receded like a dream. With mixed feelings I made my way to the beer hall on the Kurfürstendamm, where we had agreed to meet for our farewell party. I felt uneasy, but I did at least go. The spell was still strong enough for that. That was an uncomfortable evening. It was only 1 week since the orgy in Jüterbog had taken place, and the same people were there, except those who had failed, who stayed away in bitterness. But it was as though we were meeting for the very first time. We all looked different in our civilian clothes. Indeed, there were a few I did not recognize at all. I noticed that some of us had intelligent, sensitive faces, while others looked coarse and brutal. The difference had not been visible in the camp. Conversation was slow to start. We did not want to talk about the examinations. Nobody likes talking about examinations once they are safely over, but strangely we also did not want to reminisce about the camp. A few who made hearty remarks in this vein found little resonance or understanding and soon gave up. It was a little like the first day at Jüterbog. The most awkward thing was that we still felt obliged to use the familiar du. It would have been easier if we could have addressed one another as colleagues with the customary sie. We made inquiries about plans for the future and proposed half-hearted toasts. There was a rather loud band, and its rattling sentimental music filled the long gaps in the conversation. Soon the SA men formed a group of their own and started discussing higher SA politics. They grumbled about the party and the paperwork and toasted Gruppenführer Ernst. Karl Ernst, leader of the SA in Berlin, was executed in the Night of the Long Knives, June 30, 1934. We others kept aloof. We saw no reason to participate. It was not long before the whole company had split into little groups. I sat with a young man with whom I had occasionally had pleasant conversations about music, outside the camp at Jüterbog on Sundays. It turned out that we had both been to the Furtwängler concert the Sunday before. We exchanged our views. "Look at those eggheads," said somebody who had observed us for a while. We just looked at each other and ignored it. The evening became gloomier and gloomier, and by midnight we were all surreptitiously looking at our watches. Then it fell apart completely. A group of girls of doubtful virtue settled down at the next table, and some of us began to flirt with them and gradually moved over to that table or drew the bells over to our table. "Now it's getting boring," somebody said loudly, and as he prepared to leave, several of us joined him. I went too. On the street, one person suggested that we should move on somewhere, but his suggestion was met with total silence. As for me, I saw a bus approaching. "That's my bus," I shouted goodbye, waved, and jumped aboard. I left the group still standing around. I never met any of them again. The bus carried me swiftly away. I felt cold, ashamed, and relieved.